Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. Before we jump into our case today, I wanted to let you know that we have a new bonus episode about the Hartford Circus Fire over on our Patreon. On July 6, 1944, a fire broke out during an afternoon performance of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus that was attended by around 9,000 people, killing at least 167 people and leaving more than 700 injured. It was one of the worst fire disasters in United States history. So that's what we're going to be talking about over on Patreon. You can get access to that episode and a bunch of other bonus episodes at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. But today, I'll be diving into the tragic attack on the Pan family. This case has some serious twists and turns, so let's just jump in because we have a lot to discuss. Han and Bic Pan both grew up in Vietnam and moved to Canada as refugees around 1979. The couple got married in Toronto and settled in Scarborough, Canada. In 1986, they had their first daughter, Jennifer, and then in 1989 had their son, Felix. Both Han and Bic worked at an auto parts manufacturer called Magnetic International in Aurora, Ontario. Han worked as a tool and die maker, and Bic made car parts. And they worked very hard for their family. They did whatever they could to give their kids everything they never had. And by 2004, they had saved up enough money to purchase a nice house. The house was in the residential area Markham. Markham is a nice suburb of Toronto, it has a low crime rate, it's very safe, and was a family-oriented area. So the Pan family was living their dream. But everything changed for them on November 8th, 2010. Around 11 p.m. that night, 911 received a very distressed call from 24-year-old Jennifer Pan. She very frantically told the dispatcher to please send help. Three men had broken into her home, stole their money, and she didn't know where her parents were, but she heard some loud pops. She was tied up upstairs. Detective Bill Cordes was the lead investigator on the case. That night, Bill had just gotten into bed and fallen asleep when his phone rang. He was informed there was a double shooting, a very violent scene, and he would be the primary on the case. When detectives arrived on the scene, they found that Bic Pan had been killed instantly. She had been shot once in the neck and once in the head. Her husband Han had also been shot twice, but was still alive and was transported to the hospital by air ambulance. He had sustained a gunshot wound to the eye that had traveled into his skull and down into his jaw and neck, and when he arrived at the hospital, was put into an induced coma. Jennifer was found upstairs tied to the banister with a black shoelace. She was unharmed, but very shaken up. She was taken to the same hospital as a precaution. She sat by her father's bedside for around 3 hours until she was taken to the Markham police station. The Pan family were described as a hard-working, average family, so there was nothing that would explain why they were the target of such a horrific attack. Detective Bill Cordes knew he had to do a thorough look into this family's history. He needed a full analysis of the Pan's life to figure out what could have caused this attack. Did the family have enemies? Were they in trouble? They were worried Han wouldn't survive his injuries, and they'd only have one witness they could interview, their daughter Jennifer Pan. Which definitely wouldn't be ideal, but at that point, she was all they had. Around 2:44 a.m., Jennifer was brought in for her first interview with Detective Randy Slade. Slade asked Jennifer to take him back to earlier that day and walk him through it. Jennifer said her mother had been preparing dinner because she was going line dancing that night, which was something she did every Monday. She and Jennifer sat down to dinner, and then after that, Jennifer went upstairs to her room and called it a night. She put the TV on, she talked on the phone with a friend of hers, and then shortly after 9:30 p.m., she heard her mother come home from line dancing. A few minutes later, Jennifer heard some commotion, and her mother calling her father to come downstairs. Jennifer then said she peered out of her bedroom door, which was when she saw a man who rushed at her. He tied her arms behind her back and told her he had a gun. "Do what I say, and if you do, no one will get hurt." She then said he asked her to show her where the money was. Three men dragged Jennifer down the stairs and asked her mother where her purse was. Jennifer said her mother kept trying to get up, but the men kept telling her to sit down, and Jennifer didn't want her mother to get hurt, so she also told her mother to sit down. The men then asked Han where his wallet was. They took Jennifer upstairs to show them where her father's wallet was, but she didn't know, so they tied her to the banister upstairs with a black shoelace. They ended up taking around $1,100 from the primary bedroom. Jennifer, who was tied, said she could still move but was afraid to because one of the guys from earlier still had the gun. The three men then brought her parents back downstairs, and her mother asked the men if Jennifer could come with them, but they told her Jennifer had to stay there. The last thing she heard the men say to her parents was, you lied to us. She assumed when they said you lied to us, they were talking about her father's wallet. She then heard her mother scream, so Jennifer called out to her, which was followed by a few more pops. At that point in the interview with Detective Slade, Jennifer broke down in tears. Detective Cordes knew that trying to get a victim to talk about a traumatic event is very difficult, but it's critical to get the information while it's fresh. That being said, first and foremost, they needed to make sure Jennifer was fine enough to continue speaking to the investigators. Detective Deborah Gladding was the victim liaison officer on the case. Her job was to be there for the victim, and in this case, Jennifer. If Jennifer were having a hard time, Deborah Gladding was always on call for her. And she felt terrible for Jennifer. She couldn't imagine experiencing what she was going through. So in her mind, she wanted to keep things slow and steady to not overwhelm Jen even more. Jennifer was 24 years old, but during her interview, she seemed a lot younger, at least in my opinion. She had a very high-pitched voice, she talked very timidly, and she just seemed young. She did just go through a very traumatic event, so you can't expect someone to be talking completely normally, but she did seem very fragile. At 3:17 a.m., Detective Slade told Jennifer to back up. He wanted to figure out what happened right before the men left. She said she heard her mother moan, and then she heard one more pop before the men left. She also heard one of the guys say, "We have to go now, it's been too long." Although Jennifer had been tied to the banister, she was able to access her phone, which she had in the waistband of her pants, and called 911. The 911 operator asked if she could lock the door, but she told her no, since she was tied up. She wasn't able to go help her parents or be with them. Slade then asked her to describe the man who tied her up. She said one of them was black with dreadlocks. Guy 2 was also black, but thinner. He had on a hoodie, but she could tell he was darker than the first guy. And Guy 3 was also black and had a Jamaican accent. Jennifer didn't know how they got into her house, since she didn't hear them enter. Slade asked Jennifer what, in her opinion, would have caused these people to target them. He asked her if her parents kept large amounts of cash in their house or at the bank. Jennifer said they didn't keep a lot of cash at home, and the cash they had in the bank wasn't large enough to raise flags. It was just enough to pay their bills. She said her mother was very diligent about them having just enough. The family was doing well. They had worked hard and were very good at saving. Her dad drove a Mercedes that he loved and called his baby, and her mother drove a Lexus, which were pretty expensive cars. But other than that, they lived a fairly modest lifestyle. Their home was nice, but not luxurious. But it was paid off. Investigators wanted to figure out if Han was part of some kind of nefarious business deals. Did he have a gambling debt or something to do with weapons or drugs? Could this have been a dispute with a neighbor? What caused this? The scene looked typical for what police would expect a ransacked room to look like. There was bloody clothing, things strewn about, but also it seemed like they left behind things that should have been taken, like jewelry, watches, valuables, and even cash. There was a safe and a very expensive camera in the closet. There was a wallet with multiple $20 bills, which definitely would have been taken if the crime was cash-related. By 4:29 a.m., Jennifer's initial interview with detectives had concluded. Once the interview was over, Deborah Gladding took Jennifer out of the room. The two were pretty silent as they walked. Jennifer had been through a lot, and Deborah really felt for her. As they walked together, Detective Gladding was wondering to herself how Jennifer would ever recover from something like this. Her mother had been murdered, and her father was in a coma. And this case was all over the news. By all accounts, it seemed like the Pan family was just a normal, innocent family. But three gunmen knocked on the door and burst into their home. They didn't know why something so violent would happen to a seemingly average family. The next day by 8 a.m., investigators were going over the case. The first assignment Detective David McDonald was tasked with was conducting a large-scale canvass of the area in and around where the Pans lived. They were looking for any eyewitness information or any piece of evidence that may become relevant later. Police urged the public, if they had any information, whether they thought it was useful or not, to call York Regional Police. It might be that one tip that gets three violent people off of their streets. Neighbors were floored because the Pan family were kind and kept to themselves. This seemed like a completely random attack, which was extremely scary for everyone. It made the whole community feel unsafe. Markham didn't see a lot of homicides. It's a very safe and diverse area. People came from Asia, Southeast Asia, the Caribbean, all over. And it was a very quiet neighborhood. So when something so terrifying happened, it was like a bomb went off. Police promised the community they would leave no stone unturned in their investigation and identify the people who had done this. Bick's friend, Hong Go, said she had no idea why Bick would have been killed. She hung out regularly with Bick and ate dinner with the family very often. They were very hospitable and generous. They were loving friends. Han worked 5 days a week and some overtime, but he definitely wasn't involved with any shady business. He didn't gamble, and I'm not sure if he drank at all, but if he did, it wasn't excessively. According to Hong, he is a humble, down-to-earth man. Detective McDonald's canvassing had gone on for around 6 hours that day, and at first they weren't getting anything helpful. But then they finally got some information. They learned about a new person associated with the Pan family. His name was Daniel Wong. He was a drug dealer who had recently been in a relationship with Jennifer Pan. Learning about an ex-boyfriend with a shady background was a significant detail, and police believed that Jennifer should have provided information about that in her interview. And since Danny Wong was a drug dealer, they wondered if maybe he had been the reason why the family was targeted. So the next day, he was brought in for questioning. At 4:19 p.m., Daniel was asked where he was on the evening the Pan family was attacked, and he told them he was home sleeping. He got home around 9 or 10:30 p.m. He did acknowledge that he had been previously in trouble with police for possession and trafficking of drugs, but since then he had stopped. He said as soon as he got in trouble, he stopped doing all that. So they then moved into questioning Danny about his relationship with Jennifer. He clarified that he was her ex-boyfriend. They had a relationship toward the end of high school that they continued until around 2 years ago, so in total, their relationship lasted around 7 years. They had been planning to stay together, but there was a big issue with her parents. And detectives' ears perked up because that was interesting information. Danny told police Jennifer's parents were very strict. They said she had no time for a relationship, and Danny believed they didn't like him because he didn't make enough money. At the time of their relationship, he was working at a pizza place called Boston Pizza. Jen's parents really didn't approve of their relationship. Danny said throughout the entirety of his relationship with Jennifer, he never sat down and formally ate dinner with her parents or spent any real time with her family. Jennifer wanted to continue the relationship, but Danny had broken it off, telling her her parents didn't want them to be together and there was nothing they could do about it, and then he said he moved on. At the time of the interview, police learned that Danny had been seeing someone new, and her name was Christine. According to Danny, Jennifer would still call him fairly regularly and try to talk to him. Every once in a while, the two would have a conversation where they'd catch up because they were actually both getting harassed by weird private phone calls. Another weird detail. According to Danny, he had received a call from this unknown number as recently as 2 or 3 days prior. They would call, he'd answer, and then the line would go quiet for around 10 seconds, and then whoever was on the other end would hang up. And that happened over and over, and it got so ridiculous, he received like hundreds of calls. The calling then moved into ominous text messages telling him, "We're watching you." And Jen was also getting these calls. Jennifer would visit Danny at work and bring him lunch and sit with him since they were still friends. And then Danny would get texts saying, "What is she doing here? We told her to stay away." And the last message he received was, "Ha ha ha, bang bang bang." That was a significant detail. It seemed he and Jennifer had been the victims of hundreds of calls and messages over the last few months. The unknown source sent bang, 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 and then a few days later, Jennifer's parents were shot in their home. Investigators asked Danny if he felt like what had happened had something to do with him, and he said he was more than 95 to 99% sure it had nothing to do with his drugs. They asked him how he could be so certain, and he told them no one was going to shoot you over a little marijuana. And at that point, they left him in the room. Something wasn't right about this interview. They had more questions than they did answers. Was Danny Wong the target? Or Jennifer? But that wouldn't make sense because she hadn't been touched. They needed to learn everything they could about Jennifer Pan. Who she was, who she hung out with, and what she did in her spare time. Maybe there was something in her background that would shine light on this whole situation. Jennifer's parents had very high expectations of her and her brother. They were very strict with their kids and would be what some people would consider tiger parents. Tiger parenting is a strict authoritarian approach where parents push their children to excel academically and in extracurricular activities, aiming for high achievement at any cost. It's a very intense form of parenting. Jennifer had started playing piano when she was only 4 years old. She played the flute in the school band, and she also did figure skating. She was really good at figure skating and had a dream of becoming an Olympic athlete, so she spent a lot of her time training. But at 14 years old, she ended up tearing a ligament in her knee so badly that she was forced to quit figure skating altogether, and that dream was squashed. When that happened, her parents really honed in on her academics, which Jennifer wasn't nearly as gifted in. Jennifer was around a C to C minus student, and her parents wanted her to have straight A's, which most of her peers did, as well as her brother, which was a point of strain in their relationship. She was gifted musically, though. Her piano teacher, Fernando Baldassini, said Jennifer was the best of the best. She won awards at competitions, she spent so much time dedicating herself to practicing, and her parents spent thousands of dollars on lessons, competitions, everything. It was apparent how much the family had invested in that. Nam Nguyen, a high school friend of Jennifer's, met her when they were 13 years old. They went on school trips together and sometimes would go skating or catch a movie with friends, and he said that Jen was great to talk to. She was bubbly, happy, confident, and very genuine. Daniel Wong was a year older than Jen in school and was described as goofy and social, and he played the trumpet in the school band. In 2003, Danny and Jen ended up going on a big school trip together to Europe, and when they were in Europe, they performed at this concert hall that was full of smoke from people smoking cigarettes, which really aggravated Jen's asthma, and she began having a panic attack about it. And Daniel was really there for her, and he calmed her down. And she said it meant so much to her because he didn't have to do that, and she felt like he literally saved her life. Which is sweet, but also very teenage girl. And from then on, she was really into Daniel, and that summer they started dating in secret. She talked about Danny every once in a while with her friends. They seemed happy at first, but there was also a lot of drama in their relationship. Someone was always heartbroken, and they were very on and off. Nam said Daniel wasn't the best boyfriend. He remembered when Jennifer spent an entire summer working to make money and spent it all on a paintball gun for Daniel. Nam said he couldn't fathom spending a couple $1,000s on one piece of equipment, but she said she felt like she had no one better to spend it on, including herself, which demonstrates just how obsessed and in love with Daniel she really was. And at this point, police couldn't rule out anything. The news was reporting that it was possible the men had possibly gotten it wrong and broken into the wrong home, which put the community in a panic because they were worried they could be the next victims of a random attack gone wrong. They wanted answers. Police were still searching for witnesses, and at that point only had one new piece of evidence. It came from a grainy security video that police managed to get from a neighbor's security system. When they got a hold of this video, it was a big moment in the case. The video was from across the street and pointed directly at the Pan residence. And as luck would have it, they saw what looked like three suspects going into the home. It was off in the distance and very grainy, but they could make out three figures. They saw them enter the home, and then around 30 minutes later, they were seen exiting. One exited very quickly, and then a short time later, the two others ran out of the house as well. All three suspects entered through the front door. which was strange because there was no forced entry. They wanted to bring in Jennifer again, and this time ask her some more difficult questions. They wanted to know who she was involved with and what was going on with Danny Wong. So at 9:34 a.m. on day 4, Jennifer's second interview began. They started the interview by asking her about her relationship with Daniel. She told them they went to high school together, and despite her parents not wanting her to have a boyfriend, their relationship lasted around 6 or 7 years. Jennifer was asked if she thought Daniel's drug dealing could have led dangerous people to her house in search of money, and she said she never asked Daniel too much about his drug dealing. She only knew he did runs. They asked her if she had experienced any threatening behavior, in hopes that she would bring up the anonymous texts and calls, but she said yes, she had, and then she brought up the girl Daniel had been seeing. Daniel had supposedly told her they were just friends, but everyone else told her they were boyfriend and girlfriend, meaning Daniel and Christine, and this girl had texted Jennifer telling her to back off and leave Daniel alone. She said she wasn't 100% positive that those texts were from his girlfriend, but she believed it most likely was because Christine had personally messaged Jennifer on Facebook telling her she was stupid. Jen also said that there had been times that she would text Daniel, and then Daniel's new girlfriend would text Jen back using his phone, saying he's with his girlfriend Christine, please leave him alone. Jen said she didn't bring this up in the first interview with police because everything had just happened and she didn't think too much of those texts at the time. But now she was suggesting Danny Wong's new girlfriend was somehow involved in all of this. Was it possible that the harassing phone calls and text messages were coming from Christine? Investigators started thinking maybe this was a love triangle situation. But if that were the case, then how were Jennifer's parents the victims? Investigators asked Jennifer how her parents reacted when they found out she had a boyfriend, and she admitted not well. When her parents found out that Jennifer had a drug-dealing boyfriend she spent all of her time with, her father was very unhappy and gave her an ultimatum. She could either choose to live at home with her family and focus on her studies, or she could be with Daniel, but she would never come back and all financial support would end immediately. So she chose to stay at home with her family. But even after Jennifer and Daniel broke up, Jennifer wanted to secretly remain friends with him. Her parents didn't want that, but despite that, she continued calling him. Her parents would catch her sometimes and would take her cell phone away, and they told her they would have to drive her anywhere she went. All she was able to do was focus on her studies. She practiced piano and did her schoolwork, and that was about it. One day at her piano lessons, Jennifer broke down. She started sobbing, and her teacher had never seen her like that before. She told Fernando her parents didn't trust her. They watched her every move and followed her around everywhere. Her father wouldn't allow her to waste time going out with a cook. Daniel wasn't just a cook. He was dealing drugs, but from her perspective, she said, "They won't let me go out with a cook." Jennifer said after high school she wanted to study kinesiology, but her father wanted her to do something that would make her more money in the medical field. He knew she didn't have the stomach to become a doctor, so he wanted her to become a pharmacist. Her parents worried a lot about their daughter and talked about it with friends and the people in their life. They wanted her to be successful, but she was making some questionable decisions. Jennifer went to Mary Ward Catholic Secondary School, and everyone there was expected to become successful. Students would go on to become doctors, dentists, lawyers, and engineers. It was a school where getting straight A's is a standard. The school had a large immigrant population from Hong Kong, Taiwan, Vietnam, and many of the students had the same kind of pressure from their parents that Jennifer was experiencing. Which was hard enough already, but for Jennifer, she wasn't anywhere near being the top of her class, and her parents were extremely hard on her. They monitored her every move. So at this point, this is all the police really knows, but I'm going to go back in time and give you a little background information on Jennifer and on her relationship with Daniel and her parents. But the police didn't know any of this yet. When she was in high school, Jennifer had received early admission into Ryerson University, but she had failed one of her calculus classes, so they ended up revoking her admission. She didn't want her parents to find out, so she told everyone in her life that she was going to Ryerson. And she ended up faking an admission letter and giving it to her parents. It turned out Jennifer never even graduated high school, but she lied to her parents about that as well and created a fake diploma. Jennifer told her parents her plan was to attend Ryerson for 2 years and then transfer to University of Toronto and get into their pharmacology program. She told them she got a bunch of scholarship money so they wouldn't have to worry about paying, and even purchased textbooks and watched documentaries and took notes to make it seem like she was doing real work. While she was in college, she wasn't allowed to go to parties or hang out with friends, and she was teaching piano lessons on the side and was working at a restaurant to make a little extra money. The 2 years went by with her parents believing that she was studying at Ryerson University, and after those 2 years, she continued to keep up this lie that she would be going to the University of Toronto, and this time she suggested that she stay with her friend Topaz, who lived closer to University of Toronto, that way her commute wouldn't be so bad. But in reality, she would be living with Daniel, and her parents definitely didn't know that. So at this point, she is multiple years into this web of lies, and she's living with Daniel Wong without her parents' knowledge. And another 2 years went by, and they thought she had been in school for 4 years, and now it was time for her to fake graduate, which was when she and Daniel found someone online to help them forge a fake transcript and diploma. Her reasoning for why her parents couldn't come to her graduation was, they had an abnormally large class size at the university, so they could only get one ticket per student at graduation, and she didn't want to make either of her parents feel bad, so she ended up giving her one ticket away to a friend. And now that she was done with college, she told her parents that she would be volunteering at a blood testing lab called Sick Kids, and she would have to work late nights and weekends. Very convenient. She convinced her parents she would probably spend most of her time at her friend's house that she had been staying with, because once again, it was closer to her work. But her parents began to notice a few inconsistencies with Jennifer's story. She didn't have a uniform or a key card for Sick Kids, and so one day they told her that she was going to be dropped off by them at work because they wanted to see where she worked. And when they pulled up, she basically booked it out of the car and inside the hospital. They followed after her, but she hid for a few hours in the emergency room so that she didn't have to explain herself and why this wasn't her place of work, but at that point she's still keeping up the lie, but she's holding on by a thread. Her parents were definitely skeptical and knew that things were weird with Jennifer, so they called her friend Topaz and asked if Jennifer was staying there, and she told them no. Later, when she got home, her parents confronted her, and she ended up confessing that she didn't work at Sick Kids at all. She had made it all up. She also told them she didn't go to University of Toronto. She was living with Daniel. And I have to imagine after that there was a long pause, because that is a lot to take in. She did keep up the lie that she had graduated high school and went to Ryerson University, so she only confessed to like half of the lies. Her parents were, understandably, livid with her and really brought down the hammer on her because they couldn't trust her. They took away her cell phone, her laptop, cut her off from the outside world completely, and had her cut off things with Daniel. They made her quit her job at the restaurant and started tracking her mileage in her car to make sure she wasn't going anywhere she shouldn't be. In February of 2009, Jennifer posted on Facebook that living in her home was like being on house arrest. But she still did everything she could to sneak out and see Daniel. She did the classic leaving pillows underneath the blankets of her bed, and then in the morning, her mom pulled back the blankets and discovered that she wasn't in her bed, so when they figured out that she had snuck out to see Daniel, that was when her father gave her the ultimatum of choosing Daniel and being cut off or staying at home with them. He even told Jennifer, "If you want to see Daniel again, you're going to have to wait until I'm dead." And throughout all of this, Daniel was getting really sick of the drama with Jennifer, so he was the one who ended things. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back for Jennifer, so she spiraled. She felt like her parents were controlling her life and taking away the only thing that she cared about. And not long after he broke up with her, Daniel started dating Christine, which I'm sure felt like a hot knife to the heart. But like I said, police didn't know this entire story. They knew that she had lied about going to university, but she told them that her parents hadn't ever found out about that lie. Jennifer told them that she felt guilty about lying to her parents, but every time she tried to bring it up, she felt so much expectation and she was crippled by that. The police knew that she had continued this lie for 4 years and even forged a false degree from University of Toronto, but apparently her parents never questioned her about it. And to investigators, this was humongous information. They didn't know exactly how huge it was, but they did know it was significant. If she had been able to lie to her parents for 4 years in such a big and twisted way, what else hadn't she told them? And what had she been doing during the 4 years she was supposed to be at school? Police were definitely beginning to consider the possibility that Jennifer had something to do with her parents' attack because there were some really odd details around the whole thing. For instance, the 911 call. They dissected that phone call second by second to get as good of a picture as they could from it, and police found Jennifer with her hands tied behind her back to the banister upstairs. What bothered Detective Bill Cordes was, how was she able to make a phone call with her hands tied behind her back to the banister? She said she had her cell phone on her, but still, it was a very awkward position and potentially not possible at all. Jennifer had told Slade during her initial interview that the man who tied her hands behind her back tied them so tightly that she squealed. He thankfully didn't pat her down, otherwise he would have found her phone. So in this new interview, Detective Slade had Jennifer stand up in the interview room and demonstrate how she was able to make a 911 call with her hands tied behind her back. And she was able to get the phone out of her waistband and make the call, which did answer that question. But they had to address another big question mark. Why would her parents' attackers leave a surviving witness? If they were already going to shoot two people, why wouldn't they just shoot the third? They asked her why she thought they didn't shoot her, and she said that the men told her that she had cooperated. Everything that Jennifer is saying could be possible, and police are seeing that. They're thinking to themselves, okay, these explanations could be in the realm of possibility, but there's so much weirdness surrounding it, so they're not completely buying it. Police asked Jennifer if her parents had life insurance policies, and she said she didn't know. She thought so. She knew she had one when she was younger, but then half of that money went to her education and the other half went to life insurance. When her parents found out she didn't go to university, they asked her for the other half of the money back. And Detective Slade was like, hang on, I thought you said your parents never found out you didn't go to university. And Jennifer clarified that she eventually told her parents that she went for 2 years, but never finished. Detective Slade asked Jennifer about her possible resentment toward her parents for her relationship ending and for kind of locking her down in her own house. Jennifer told him, despite everything they did, she loved her parents and chose to be with them. If she wanted to, she could have just left, but she wanted to stay with them and take care of them. Again, she had an answer, but they could tell that Jennifer wasn't telling them everything. She was clearly nervous. Her body language made it seem to Cordes that she was holding something back. She was fidgeting a lot, running her fingers through her ponytail, keeping her head down. And the only other witness was Han, but he was still in a coma, so they couldn't interview him. So until then, every possibility had to stay on the table. And as the case went on, things started to lag a little bit, but investigators had to keep up this momentum. York Regional Police set up a command post in the neighborhood to try to ease residents' worries and try to take in as many tips as possible. And not long after that, Cordes learned that Han had been taken out of his coma. So this was the first time they felt that they would get a full picture of what happened that night. Detective McDonald went to the hospital and found Han still hooked up to so many machines. One of the first things they noticed was his right eye had been bruised, and he had a very small dot between his right eye and his nose, which was where he had been shot. Han told them that night he had gone to bed early, around 8:30. His wife had been line dancing and Jennifer was at home. Han was then suddenly woken up out of his sleep by a man with a gun who told him to get up and go downstairs. He saw his wife in the living room, hysterical, telling the men over and over, "We don't have any money, you can let us go." One of the men told her to shut up. Han was then pistol-whipped, and Bick was sitting on a separate couch begging for her life. And while that was happening, Jennifer walked down the stairs in the company of one of the suspects. She was without bindings on her hands and appeared to be in friendly conversation with them. And this blew up the case. They felt like things were off, but now they knew Jennifer had lied about way more. They were immediately convinced that Jennifer was in on the murder of her mother and attempted murder of her father. So Cordes stationed uniformed officers at the hospital and told them that under no circumstances was Jennifer allowed in the room with her father alone. The next day, McDonald went back to the hospital to visit Han again. And during that visit, he told McDonald to use your police techniques to find out what Jennifer did. This is such a huge and heartbreaking moment in the case because Jennifer is obviously painting one very specific manipulative picture, playing the very scared, innocent, upset daughter. And then Han wakes up from his coma and tells them, Jennifer seemed to know these people, was in friendly conversation with her, and you need to use your police techniques to find out what my daughter did. It didn't seem like there was any ounce of him that was questioning what he had seen. So 2 weeks after the attack, Jennifer was brought in for her third interview. This time, police knew that she was involved. This interview was paramount for the investigation, and they knew that Jennifer had plenty of experience with casting a web of lies, so this time she'd be talking to Bill Gates, who was trained in identifying and detecting lies. And no, it is not that Bill Gates. His last name is spelled G-O-E-T-Z, but apparently is pronounced Gates. By bringing in Gates, Jennifer would be meeting her match. But he started the interview out in a very friendly way, talking about how he had taken piano lessons in the past and was just trying to relate to her and keep her calm. But then they got into the real questions. He asked her, had her parents not interfered, would she still be with Daniel? And she said she didn't know, because he had moved on. But she felt like part of her was missing when Daniel left. It felt like her friends were moving on with their lives and she wasn't going anywhere. She felt like she was being left behind. Jennifer even admitted to self-harm because she was so depressed. Gates then told her that he was an expert in truth verification. He's not a homicide detective. Jennifer didn't know it, but in Canada, police are allowed to lie if they need to. He told her his job is to go over all of the forensics of the case, and the police were going to comb through everything with a very fine-tooth comb. He then told her about a satellite technology that they were using to investigate the case. This satellite knows if people are moving around in a house. It's basically like an X-ray, so they knew if the people in the home were in the positions that they claimed to be in. Which was a lie, but Jennifer didn't know that. And if that were true, they would know that she was walking around with these intruders and not tied against the banister for most of the intrusion. They wanted to see if Jennifer would change up her story a little and come up with another lie to cover up the fact that she was walking around the house with the attackers. But Jennifer didn't say anything. And Gates told her that she knew the attackers and the whole thing went wrong when her father survived and became a witness. He said she gave a description of a black guy with dreads, but there was no one in the house that fit that description. And he pressed her, why did she say that? She told him that's what she remembered. But he told her he knew she was involved in this, and Jennifer didn't respond. She bent over with her head in her lap and began talking very quietly. Jennifer whispered to Gates, they were supposed to kill her. She didn't want to live anymore. Gates asked, so they were supposed to take the whole family out? And she whimpered, no, just me. Cordes, who was watching through the two-way glass in the next room, couldn't believe what he was hearing. Suicide by hitman didn't seem very likely, but this was all very shocking. So Gates asked her what went wrong, and she told him she didn't know. Eventually, Jennifer sat up and told Gates it wasn't supposed to happen like this. So Gates, of course, asked her, how was it supposed to happen? She told him, quote, come in and take me out. The hitman was going to charge $2,000. She didn't know his real name, but he went by Homeboy. Jennifer told Gates she paid them the money, and they called her to make sure that they had access to her home. She would text them the code VIP access, and that's how they would know they could come in. So after Bick got home, Jennifer said she came downstairs, said hello to her mother, and then pretended to check the door, but really, she unlocked it. Investigators knew that almost everything she was saying was total bullshit. Criminals aren't the brightest a lot of the time, but the idea that this group of people would get it wrong and kill her parents instead of her was a complete lie. Investigators had to get a warrant for Jennifer's phone because there was definitely communication between Jennifer and these hitmen. She told Gates she had gotten in contact with Homeboy through a friend, but she wouldn't give that friend's name. When they got access to Jennifer's home, everything fell into place. They quickly found Homeboy's contact and the messages between him and Jennifer. Homeboy said, "I need the time of completion. Think about it." And Jennifer told him, "Today is a no-go. Dinner plans." What was particularly interesting were the text messages between Daniel Wong and Jennifer. Jennifer asked him, "Do you love me and want to be with me?" Daniel texted back, "I'm really down right now, Jen. I'm sorry." Jennifer answered, "What do you mean? What are you sorry for? Can you please answer?" Daniel responded, "I don't know how to say this. I feel the way you feel, but about her." Jennifer said, "You feel for Christine what I feel for you? Then call it off with Homeboy." Daniel said, "Call it off with Homeboy? You said you wanted this with or without me. You said you wanted this for you." And then he got angry at her, telling her he was always walking on eggshells with her and did everything for her and lined this all up for her. Safe to say that was the nail in the coffin for Daniel Wong. He had obviously assisted Jennifer in contacting Homeboy, and in reality, the two had come up with the plan together to take out both of her parents. Daniel had actually given Jennifer an iPhone as a burner phone to talk to Homeboy, and for other illegal activities. Police put a surveillance team on Danny Wong and also got his phone, and they were pretty quickly able to identify Eric Carty as one of the suspects, David Milvagnanum as another, I hope I didn't butcher that name, and Homeboy was Lenford Crawford. Lenford was someone Danny worked with, who also dealt drugs. Homeboy told Jennifer that he usually charged $20,000 for that kind of thing, but he would give them a friends and family discount and charge only $10,000. On the day of the attack, Homeboy texted Jennifer, "Game time," and Daniel texted her, "Be safe." She waited until her mom came back from line dancing and came downstairs to say goodnight to her. She walked over to the door, unlocked it, and then went back upstairs to give the green light to Homeboy. She turned the lights on and off in their study to signal for them to come inside the house, and then texted VIP access. And then she waited in her bedroom for everything to happen. After her interview with Gates, Jen was arrested for murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. When the news broke that Jennifer Pan was responsible for the attack on her parents, the community was floored. People who knew Jennifer couldn't believe that she had done it. They felt betrayed. Detective Gladding was also extremely shocked. She had so much sympathy for Jennifer and thought that she had connected with her. She couldn't believe she had done something like that. How was this innocent, sad girl able to do so much evil? After her arrest, they found Jennifer's diary, which gave them an even closer look into her state of mind. She complained that her parents were very hard on her and restrictive, but only because they didn't want their daughter dating a drug dealer. In Jennifer's words, they worried that he would bring her life down. And I don't think that that is an unreasonable thing for them to think. That was one of the biggest motives. Her parents didn't want her dating a drug dealer. They thought he would bring her life down. Everything else in her diary was about Daniel and being with him, complete with doodles of hearts, butterflies, and puppies. Her end goal was to run away into the sunset with Daniel Wong and would do anything to make that happen. At the time of her parents' attack, Jennifer was 24 years old. But like I said in the beginning, she seemed so much younger, and in my opinion, these diary entries also kind of proved how immature she was. It just feels like a middle schooler's diary, doodling hearts and butterflies and puppies and talking about how she's going to run away in the sunset with Daniel Wong. And how unreasonable it was that her parents didn't want her to be with someone who was going to bring down her life. Her parents definitely put a lot of pressure on her, and I could understand how that would be extremely difficult to grow up in a home like that and to have that never-ending pressure. But Jennifer wasn't doing herself any favors because she had cast such a humongous web of lies, and once her parents found out about how many lies she had truly told them and for how long she had kept it up for, of course they're not going to trust her. Of course they think that this guy who's involved with shady business is influencing their daughter and helping her make these terrible decisions, whether that was true or not. The whole situation is just unbelievable. Police believed that the hundreds of calls and text messages and threats Daniel Wong received was actually from Jennifer, trying to get Christine out of the picture and herself back in it. Police wondered why Daniel would even want to get involved, considering he already had another relationship. But there was a potential monetary gain for him in this attack. If they had been successful in killing both of her parents, Jennifer would have gotten $500,000. and Daniel probably could have gotten some of that for himself. She was clearly obsessed with him, so it probably wouldn't have even been that difficult. Investigators then discovered that this wasn't even Jennifer's first attempt to kill her father. 10 months prior, she had approached a friend of hers and asked him to do the job. She even gave him $2,000 for it, but he never went through with it. But she clearly wanted it to happen. Her trial lasted almost 10 months, but since they had so many text messages, there wasn't much the defense could do. She was found guilty of first-degree murder of her mother and attempted murder of her father. Jennifer, Daniel Wong, and the other men were sentenced in 2015 to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. Eric Carty was tried separately after his lawyer fell ill and actually got a lesser sentence because he pled guilty, but he ultimately died in prison in 2018. Han wasn't at his daughter's sentencing, but wrote a statement that said, "When I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what happened to her family and can become a good, honest person someday." Han has had a really hard time since the attack. He's dealt with chronic pain, anxiety, insomnia, and since then stayed out of the public eye. Han and her brother Felix were also granted a lifetime non-contact order against his daughter. My heart just breaks for both of them. The whole situation is so devastating, and it's hard to wrap your head around someone being so evil and doing something so awful to their family and being able to lie about it for so long. But most recently, according to an article on CanadianLawyerMag.com from this April, a Supreme Court of Canada majority ordered a new trial for Jennifer Pan and the individuals who allegedly helped her orchestrate the violent attack on her parents, overturning their first-degree murder convictions regarding Pan's mother and opening the possibility they will be convicted on less serious charges. The defendants appealed, arguing that the trial made several errors. They alleged the judge erred by telling the jury that only two possible scenarios could establish the defendant's guilt. In one, the defendants had planned to murder both of Pan's parents. In the other, the Pans had been shot in the commission of a home invasion robbery. According to the defendants, the judge should have allowed the jury to consider a third scenario, that they planned only to kill Pan's father, and that they had killed her mother while carrying out that plan. This scenario left open the possibility of second-degree murder or manslaughter convictions for some of the defendants instead of a more serious first-degree murder conviction. The defendants also argued that the judge erred by not dismissing an allegedly biased juror, allowing a slideshow presentation by the Crown to go into the jury room, and telling the jury how to use evidence about the character of Eric Carty, another defendant who was tried in a separate case. The Court of Appeal for Ontario granted the defendants' appeal, ruling that the jury should have been permitted to consider the third scenario. This is because the scenario had an quote-unquote air of reality, meaning there is a realistic possibility that a reasonable jury could acquit on a principal offense like first-degree murder and convict on an included offense like second-degree murder or manslaughter. The appellate court ordered a new trial on the first-degree murder charge. However, the court declined to overturn the convictions for the attempted murder of Pan's father. One of Jennifer's lawyers, Stephanie DiGiuseppe, said Jennifer still has a long road ahead of her, but this is a very important day toward her hope of one day establishing her innocence in relation to these charges. She's very happy, of course, with the Supreme Court results and is looking forward to having an opportunity for a retrial in relation to the death of her mother. So when a criminal defendant is acquitted of an offense like first-degree murder because they did not meet all the criteria for a conviction, they may still meet the criteria to be convicted of an included or lesser offense like second-degree murder or manslaughter. So juries must be allowed to consider such included offenses if there is, quote-unquote, a realistic possibility of an acquittal on the principal offense and a conviction on the included offense. So point being, Jennifer Pan will be getting a retrial, and their hope is that she will get a lesser charge. Personally, I hope that that doesn't happen. This seems like one of those moments where they get a retrial based on a technicality, so that sucks. But that is the latest news in this case. I really wish I had better news for the ending of this case, but this one is just tragic and evil. I just hope that Han and Felix have been able to move forward the best they can and continue to do better as time goes on. But I could imagine that having a retrial would open up those old wounds and make it even harder for them, which just really sucks. And throughout this entire thing, Jennifer has always maintained her innocence, of course, but in my opinion, she deserves the life in prison, and I hope she stays there. But that is the case of Jennifer Pan and the attack of her family. The whole thing is so eerie. There's a documentary on Netflix called What Jennifer Did that I got a lot of my information from, and in that documentary, you can watch a good amount of the interviews between Jennifer and the police, and you can watch how she responds to things and how convincing she was in her first interview and how affected she seemed by her parents' attack. She put on a pretty good show. I think her interviews are also pretty readily available on like YouTube and stuff. It's just kind of interesting to watch someone be so calculated and manipulative because she was able to make herself kind of like react as if she had just experienced this massive trauma. Like she flinched when someone moved too quickly or shut the door and there was a loud noise and she was talking really quietly and really timidly and she just seemed very affected. So it really goes to show, in my opinion, how good she was at telling lies and how manipulative she actually was. I mean, if you really think about how much it would actually take to lie to your family for 4 years with such a complicated web of lies, it would take a lot. So she definitely had practice, is my point. The clips of the interview also go to show you how calculated Danny Wong was, because in his interview, he was also able to stay very calm and he talked very matter-of-factly. And it's just crazy to think about his involvement in this whole thing because he did have another relationship. Like, it's one thing, it's still obviously messed up and awful and whatever, for them to still be in a secret relationship and they kill Jennifer's parents to then, you know, run away into the sunset together. That's bad enough. But to think that he had a whole other relationship who he claimed to Jennifer that he loved so much, and then for him to still willingly participate in all of this, it's just so messy and terrible. I mean, obviously, a monetary gain is a pretty big motivator for so many people, so I guess there is that, but it's just scary to see how evil these people really were. But anyway, that's all I really have to say about that. But before we end, why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser? That way we can go back into our days as normal, and I can tell you something good that's completely unrelated. My good thing this week is that Alex and I are going to Chicago. This will be my first real time in Chicago. I have technically been to the city once before, but I was there for less than 24 hours. I barely saw anything, so it doesn't really count in my mind. And this time we're going and visiting friends and spending the weekend there, so I'm trying to piece together our itinerary, but it seems like there's so much to do. Chicago's an awesome city from what I understand. I guess I can't really say with personal experience, but yeah, it's really exciting. We might go to the aquarium or do like a boat tour. We're definitely going to see the Bean. But yeah, I think it's going to be great. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get access to almost 40 bonus episodes that are full length and a bunch of other bonus perks, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram @nottoday_podcast. You can also find the link to our merch shop in our Instagram bio. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the TN podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.